From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, the Milwaukee Water Commons makes a splash this weekend with their We Are Water project on Bradford Beach Sunday evening. Then a new book tells the history of the Milwaukee County Zoo.
Gradually, as they acquired more animals, the zoo developed slowly over time from 12 deer and an eagle to what we have today.
Singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves on the merits of writing story songs.
I actually think it's a little bit easier just because if you already have the story, then you don't have to make up very much. You already have kind of the framework to work with. You just got to figure out how to make it rhyme.
And we'll hear the next audio postcard from the Listening to Mitchell Public Art Project. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio, and I'm Bonnie North. Happy August. It's nice having you with us today. Over the past few years, Bradford Beach, along Milwaukee's Lake Michigan shore, has become a popular gathering place for sun, surf, and volleyball enthusiasts. But if you happen to be in the neighborhood this coming Sunday, you'll observe a different kind of celebration at the north end of the beach. Called We Are Water, the event incorporates music and art, and everyone's invited to help create a temporary art installation that celebrates the Great Lakes. The event has been months in the making, and it's the work of a group called Milwaukee Water Commons. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz has followed the group's evolution, starting with a workshop in a church basement off West Fond du Lac Avenue last March.
Alexa Bradley had her first conversation about the Water Commons idea in Milwaukee almost 3 years before this group of 24 people showed up for a chilly Saturday afternoon workshop.
Some amazing things have come out of the stories.
A longtime activist and Milwaukee native, Bradley helped incubate the Commons idea in Minneapolis. She went on to help create the Great Lakes Commons that is taking shape in places like Toronto and Cleveland, and especially in Milwaukee. It's Milwaukee's Water Commons around which Bradley is here to cultivate passion.
We're growing a city. We're growing a water city. And each of us are like a little ripple.
And if you want to make a really big ripple, we will not cut you off if you want to do more than two interviews. Have at it.
Bradley now lives in Brooklyn, New York, so it's Anne Brummett's job to keep the momentum going day to day. She comes to Milwaukee Water Commons by way of having coordinated the Milwaukee River Greenway Project. She says Water Commons planning started in earnest in early 2013.
It was a pilot project, and we were really interested in talking to people around Milwaukee about the proposition that Milwaukee is becoming a freshwater hub, or as we prefer, a freshwater city. And what does that mean across the city? And who is engaged in that conversation? And then questions about how can we keep stewardship at the center of that vision.
Many conversations later, representatives from six neighborhoods around the city agreed to commit to the effort.
In each of those neighborhoods, they can in turn get residents connected to some form of stewardship. Today is the very first session to start those projects, to start interviewing people in their neighborhoods, and then to sort of create a new story here about how Milwaukee thinks about itself and water.
I introduced myself earlier. I'm Melanie Arians, and I am the resident artist for Milwaukee Water Commons. And in my personal studio work, all of the work focuses on the Great Lakes and freshwater issues.
Art is key to the Commons, and it's Melanie Arians' job as artist in residence to inspire the group.
And so this is my shrine that I keep in my studio.
She brought her Great Lakes altar as an inspiration. Arians' bejeweled concoction, incorporating mirror, water-filled goblet, even a skull, is displayed on a small silver-gilded table. Now it's the group's turn to create.
And the project you're going to do today is you're going to make your own little desktop or tabletop shrine to the Great Lakes in an Altoid tin.
Angela Kingswan joins in at the tables strewn with art supplies. She says she wears more than one hat in her community, including
the American Indian Council on Alcoholism. I am their yoga instructor and native herbalist.
So tell me the essence of what you knew coming in and what you think the potential is here.
Well, I knew it was about bringing awareness to the state of our water and to get people involved in the issues that we face in Milwaukee surrounding water. I've always been a swimmer, and as a Native person, I feel that our waters have a spirit that needs to be respected. And I think that our Native community has been segmented for a very long time. And because I do outreach to all of the different Native nations throughout Milwaukee, I want to start this project and get people involved and coming together. I think that's the only way that our environment is really actually going to heal.
Everyone's assignment today, beyond creating a personal shrine, is to go out and talk with 25 people in his or her neighborhood. King Swan says she's looking forward to reaching out.
Oh, I'm going to be talking to probably more than 25. They were laughing at me because I do. I talk to a lot of people, and if there's something I'm passionate about, I want to get involved. I'm all in. And
so I assume you're all in here.
Yes, and I have no doubt that there are a lot of people that I know who will be as well.
All right, everybody. I think it's a fine day in Milwaukee for heading out to see the water treatment plant.
I hoped
Let's
to check
go.
In on King Swan's outreach progress a couple of months later when I stopped in at another gathering. This time, it includes a tour of Jones Island. The Commons circle seems to be growing. I see faces I didn't see in the church basement. Among them is Sherry Johnson. She has the unique distinction of being spiritual caretaker of another Milwaukee Water Commons partner, Alice's Garden, located off of Fond du Lac and North. She learned connecting to our water is new to many of the people with whom she works, so Alice has jumped into water commons projects with gusto.
We are going to have some water art projects in the garden this summer. On July 27th, we're walking from Alice's garden to Lake Park. So we want to walk there and talk about water and even walk along the river a little ways.
So has your own knowledge of water increased?
I had never thought about the watershed before, just the whole renewal of knowledge of how the Great Lakes are connected.
Johnson was baffled by some of the things she learned.
A number of times I've heard that there are a lot of people who don't go to the lake because it's just a foreign place or because it's dirty or they don't feel welcomed. I go to the lake all the time because I just love the lake and I go, but I had never thought that there were people who wouldn't go to the lake. I mean, I've known there are many children who have never been to the lake, you know, and part of it is access, you know, transportation for getting there, understanding that it can be a safe place. So even if we manage to create access to our waterways that is truly open to everyone in our community, I mean, that would be amazing. That would be a step toward health.
Aeration basin. Secondary treatment.
There's a young person on the sewage treatment tour who is raptly taking in its every sight and sound.
For the brown stuff, I thought it was poop. It's microorganisms that ate the stuff that's the black stuff.
Preschooler Bobby.
He puts water, air into the water. That's why it's bubbly.
As it turns out, Bobby comes by his keen interest naturally. His mom, Jamie Montgomery Baker, is a member of the Milwaukee Water Commons team.
I help with the organizing, so I help to identify the neighborhoods and the folks that will be working on the project.
She says her previous work as a civic organizer drew her to its mission.
It's an issue that's not being looked at and really focused on in the communities where I'm from, that I was raised. I'm born and raised in Milwaukee. So you're trying to put food on your table. You're trying to get good employment. You're not in water. We stay on Lake Michigan, so it's just kind of an assumption that it will be here and that'll be clean. And so it just in my work as a civic organizer and the little bit of work that I saw happening around water, I just felt compelled, or I just wanted to learn more about it and become smart in what's happening with our water and paying attention to it to bring that information back to my community, my neighborhood, my people.
Can you all go back to your spaces and each of you grab
just a few days before the big bash at Bradford Beach, a crew of 10 to 13-year-olds are in high artistic production at another of Milwaukee Water Commons partners, Core El Centro. located in Walker's Point. Part of its focus is health and wellness for people in the neighborhood. El Centro's nutrition director, Stephanie Calloway, enlisted her summer camp kids to cultivate stewardship around reducing the use of throwaway plastic water bottles in the building.
We've separated the recycling bin and said we're collecting bottles of water for the kids' camp, and it's scary in some ways to see how quickly they've accumulated, but it's also, that's the reminder of why we're focusing on bottled water and reducing bottled water consumption.
The kids are having a blast with the accumulated bottles. They've been colorfully painted in hues of blue by another group of campers. Now this crew cuts them into beautiful spirally tendrils. Calloway says teaching the kids about where our water comes from was something most had never before heard.
You could see their eyes open when I talked about that bottled water is just someone else's tap water. And, you know, and that thinking about where all the plastic is coming from and where all that goes. We'll have to keep reviewing the project for it to really sink in, because I think for a lot of them, it's the first time they've heard about it.
You might have picked up on the voice of Water Commons artist in residence, Melanie Arians. She's here working her magic on the kids, helping them decorate their own personal not-to-throw-away water bottles.
They used colored duct tape, glittery letters to put their name on it, and some images of the Great Lakes. And it was a great time for us to have a conversation about why we use refillable bottles.
Before the week is out, Arians plans to corral the campers to help transform the 100-plus disposables before our eyes into a work of art.
A big Dale Chihuly style-inspired sculpture.
The kids are having a ball with their blue spirally hair.
El Centro's spirally sculpture will not be part of the temporary art installation at Bradford Beach. Arians says you just have to be there to be part of that creation.
Yeah.
Oh, and in case you wondered, remember the hike planned from Alice's Garden to Lake Park? 50 people made the 5-mile hike. For many, it was their first time walking along the Milwaukee River, part of their watershed. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Milwaukee Water Commons' We Are Water event takes place this Sunday from 6:30 until 9 p.m. at the north end of Bradford Beach. Everyone is welcome, and the event will feature an illuminating experience at sundown. It is all happening at the zoo, and a new book chronicles the history of one of Milwaukee's iconic institutions. We'll talk with the authors next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The history of the Milwaukee County Zoo is as colorful as its animals and attractions. Over the decades, the zoo has collected and acquired diverse animals from all over the world and greatly contributed to the field of zoology. Some animals in particular have stood out in the zoo's history. Besides Samson the gorilla, who may be the zoo's most famous animal, there's the bear who ate his way through the wooden cage, and Jacob the hippo, who reportedly only understood German. Authors Mary Kazmierczak, Elizabeth Frank, and Darlene Winter have captured the full history of the zoo in their new book, Milwaukee County Zoo. It's from the Images of America series. They came to Lake Effect to talk with Eleanor Peterson about how the zoo began here and why the city chose Washington Park to be its first location.
The German immigrants who came to Milwaukee believed that a zoo made the city a real city. Was the city had sort of reached its status as a major city in the United States. And so having a zoo became very important to them because they were used to the zoos in their own home country. So German-American groups banded together, and because Milwaukee is such a German city, the city government was also largely German, and they decided to build a zoo in what became first West Park, which was actually outside the city limits of Milwaukee. It was a farm that they purchased the land for the zoo. And then gradually, as they acquired more animals, the zoo developed slowly over time from 12 deer and an eagle to what we have today.
Was the zoo accessible at all? Because if it's outside the city limits, and this is right when the cars started to come out, how did the Milwaukeeans get to the zoo?
Well, West Park was one of the largest parks in the city park system. There was always public conveyance to the zoo. The zoo proper didn't really develop until the early 1900s when there was public transportation available. West Park originally had a golf course. It had a horse racing track. It was a large tract of land, so it was the place where people went for their summer recreation.
How did the zoo acquire animals without tax dollars? Because the tax dollars was meant for the buildings, but they weren't allowed to spend the money on the animals. So how did they get the animals?
That was really a decision of the Milwaukee Park Commission, that tax dollars couldn't be spent on animals. So they got animals mostly through donations, which is why in 1906 is the first history of the Washington Park Zoo and the Elephant Show booklet. And it talks about the zoo having an eagle and a nasty-tempered goat. they had 200 rats, white rats. One girl donated her guinea pig. So it was a very eclectic collection.
The donations came from the people in Milwaukee or nationwide or internationally?
People in Milwaukee. It really was a Milwaukee organization. And this was how people showed their civic pride. The Park Commission was offered animals that they couldn't take care of. They were offered a leopard or a jaguar, and they didn't have anything to house it. So they turned down some bears early on and finally decided to take a bear cub. And the bear cub did fine, and then they hibernated it in the barn, and in the spring it ate its way out of the barn. So they needed to do something more substantial to contain their charges.
What role did the Washington Park Zoological Society, which is now the Zoological Society of Milwaukee, play in the formation of the zoo?
Well, the Zoological Society actually was formed as a result of not being able to use tax dollars to purchase animals. And so prominent figures in Milwaukee created this Zoological Society for the purpose of taking care and purchasing animals.
What I read in the book was that it's also a private-public relationship.
The Washington Park Zoological Society is now what is considered a 501c3. It was always a private organization, a charitable organization. But on its first board of directors was Ed Bean, who was the zoo director. The secretary of the Zoological Society was Frank Shoemaker, who was secretary of the Milwaukee Park Commission. So in those days, there wasn't this big separation between government and private entities. They raised money for animals. They had a hippo in a week campaign to raise $1,500 to buy a hippo. They gave plays and concerts and did anything they could think of to raise money.
Now, was that hippo named Jacob?
Yes.
He was one of my favorites because he was the one who only understood German.
That's the story.
Yes.
So it kind of brings out the whole Germanic roots of the zoo.
Well, the Germanic roots go deeply because Otto Kean, who was the first president of the Zoological Society, was a German immigrant, was always interested in animals. He raised birds as a youth and received a medal from Kaiser Wilhelm for his pigeons. He was a merchandise broker, and he traveled often between Milwaukee and Germany. So Carl Hagenbeck was one of the major German dealers, and so a lot of the animals came from Hagenbeck. In the Zoological Society's first annual reports, most of their honorary members are German zoo directors. And there are no American zoo directors listed. They are all German zoo directors.
I find it interesting that they would start a deer park when, at least today, deer are fairly common in Wisconsin.
Deer were fairly common then, but as the city developed, it was such an urban environment that a lot of people didn't see deer. When Milwaukee was settled, wolf hunting was a sport in the city of Milwaukee. And I'm sure wolves were extirpated fairly early from the city limits. So, again, it was the idea of the parks being the lungs of the city and providing nature for the people who had no nature where they lived.
And deer, you can go in and feed them once they become acclimated to people. You can feed them and pet them. They're not going to bite the children's heads off or fingers off. So it's a sort of safe entree to wild animals.
And then as the Great Depression hits, animals had developed by this point. There's been a wider variety, and we've had more animals from the wild, including the boar. However, they were looking to sell some of the animals to the restaurants. Why was that the case, and were they successful?
Well, it was the Depression, and the zoo, of course, didn't have the money. I mean, they were running out of money to feed these animals. And so they were hoping that the restaurants would take some of the animals off their hands, basically. And so they tried selling them. But fortunately, the citizens of Milwaukee just were horrid by this. And so they put up a big stink that they could not do this.
And those animals were donated by the society. And so it became an issue of, look, we've donated them to you for the enjoyment of the people of Milwaukee. You know, our agreement with you was we donate the animals, you take care of them. And, you know, you can't just start selling them off. This is the common heritage of all the people of Milwaukee.
There was a bone of contention between the Milwaukee Parks Department and the society. That part of the agreement had never really been ironed out.
Because they never thought it was going to get to that point.
Exactly. The society thought, you know, we bought the animals, we donated them to you. They thought they owned the animals, and the Park Commission went, well, no, we own the animals. So it was contentious.
But how did they pull through the Depression then?
They didn't get a lot of new animals during the Depression, so when animals die in captivity, you don't replace them.
They also grew some of
their own food,
on a farm that was given to, you know, for the zoo, and so that helped also.
They also had a pair of Siamese cats and sold Siamese kittens. They raised kittens and sold them as part, and they got money for the kittens that they raised.
How did the county finally decide to move the zoo?
Well, part of it is that the zoo is hemmed in by the city. When it was originally created, Washington Park was on the outskirts of the city. And now, in the 1940s, the city surrounds Washington Park and the zoo. So the zoo had no place to grow. So it was sort of a small zoo. And the Zoological Society, the Washington Park Zoological Society, wanted to grow the zoo so it would continue to be a top-tier zoo throughout the United States and the world. But what really brought about the end of the Washington Park Zoo is the construction of Highway 41, took out the bear dens, which were a very popular feature of the zoo. Milwaukee has always been a bear zoo. We've always had a lot of bears in the collection. And so some of the most popular animals at the zoo were no longer going to be on exhibit because the freeway was going through 41 to the stadium. So that was really what instigated or was the final push to move the zoo to a new location, a larger location.
We can thank baseball.
Then one of the major attractions that is still there today is the Zoo Line. What made the Zoo Line so popular, and how is it one of the biggest, largest non-animal attractions for the current zoo?
We have four engines today, two steam and two diesel. They are actual miniaturized versions. I forget the gauge, like one quarter the size of a full steam engine or diesel engine. We're one of the few zoos that has a real train. Most of the zoo trains around the country are on wheels that are just on concrete. They built the train line before anything else was built at the zoo. And people could come out and ride the train for free and see the progress of the development of the zoo. So it was a way to...
The train was never free.
The train was never free? Okay.
No, the train was donated by the journal company. And the money from the train went into the animal fund to purchase animals for the new zoo. But it was the first attraction. And
you could come out and ride around the zoo and watch the zoo being built.
And they just never took it out.
No, because it made money.
It's still
it's very popular.
Yeah, the fund now pays for transportation of animals and pays for the library and archives that we have. So the train fund is still operational and it's still doing a lot of good at the zoo.
What do you hope to accomplish with this book?
I'd like to see people in Milwaukee recognize that the zoo is indeed a cultural gem, a educational gem within the community. We still have a very urban population. And so most children in the greater Milwaukee area don't get to see animals in the wild. And so they can come here, they can learn about animals, they can see the animals. We have a lot of volunteers who work on our remains to be seen carts where we have animal artifacts so they can touch artifacts, skulls, bones, fur, and get a connection to the animals. Because as people connect to animals at the zoo, they then connect to animals in the wild and will work to preserve animals in the wild. And as the human population of the Earth continues to grow, areas where wild animals live are becoming increasingly smaller, and there is a lot more human-wild animal conflict. And we're at a stage where, you know, elephants may be extinct in the not-too-distant future. Certainly, orangutans in the wild may be extinct within 10 years. So we're hoping that this book spurs people to come back to the zoo if they haven't been to the zoo in the last couple of years and really see how zoos are different and learn more about animals and how we care for the animals at the zoo, what goes into the care of animals at the zoo, as well as the conservation of animals in the wild.
I'm sure, too, that a lot of people are going to remember the zoo when it was in Washington Park, and they're going to have a lot of fond memories about the neighborhoods there or what have you.
What I hope people see is that how a zoo really is a reflection of its city. I see this as two stories. The story of the Zoological Society is really the story of Milwaukee and mostly German Milwaukee, because the people in Zoological Society were really interested in the zoo as a Milwaukee institution, as part of Milwaukee. And the zoo itself as the development of a profession. Ed Bean came from Illinois. He was always interested in zoo profession. He was one of the founders of the American Zoo and Aquarium Association that is a professional organization today. His descendants are still working in zoos around the country today. So it's two stories that really meld in one institution. The other thing I want people to see is our last chapter is devoted to the efforts that the Zoological Society and the zoo make of conservation in the wild. I don't think we do enough to promote the good work that we do and how important it is.
Well, Darlene, Elizabeth, and Mary, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Milwaukee County Zoo was written by Mary Kazmierczak, the librarian and information specialist for the Milwaukee County Zoo and the Zoological Society of Milwaukee, Elizabeth Frank, a former zookeeper and curator who now volunteers at the zoo's library and archive, and Darlene Winter, a local author who promotes the zoo through her work. They all spoke with Eleanor Peterson, and there's more from their interview at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Their book was just released earlier this week, and the authors will be signing copies on Saturday from 10 to noon at the zoo and from 2 to 4 at the Barnes & Noble on South 76th Street in Greenfield. We'll go into our performance studio next. Singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves chats with Mitch Tyke and plays a few tunes when we come back. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.
Sometimes you wonder why you went. You don't wonder what you stayed on for. You've been home for a couple of
years. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. For a singer-songwriter, Slade Cleaves isn't the most loquacious guy you'll ever meet. The About section of his website says, Slade Cleaves grew up in Maine, lives in Texas, writes songs, tries to be good. It turns out that all the really important stuff is in his songs. Cleaves writes about love and loss and longing, but he doesn't shy away from difficult topical subjects either, as this song, Still Fighting the War, the title track off his newest album, proves. Cleaves, along with guitarist Scrappy Judd Newcomb, stopped by the Lake Effect studio a couple of weeks ago to chat with Mitch Tyke.
But spread is fraying, fading and tearing apart. Two strangers holding each other in the dark. Tell me, what were you dreaming? How did you think it would end? How many heroes are scattered out into the wind? And all the happily ever afters turn to broken dishes and slamming doors. You've been home for a couple of years now, buddy, but you're still fighting the war.
Slade Cleaves with Scrappy Judd Newcomb, Still Fighting the War. What a beautiful, heartbreaking song. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
And welcome to Milwaukee.
Hey, thanks so much. It's been a couple of years.
Yeah, it's been a while. It must have been something to have written that song, especially with its references to the VA, and have all of this controversy about the VA suddenly come to the fore. I mean, you have tapped into something that is on a lot of people's minds.
Yeah, I felt that happening as I was going through the various versions of the song. It developed over a period of a few years when the VA issue would kind of come and go and come and go, and then it came to the fore in the media big time just as the record was about to be released. So we thought we'd tie in with some veterans organizations with the album release, and that was really great to get to know some of those people and to funnel some donations their way, and it felt good.
Have you had a chance to perform the song much for veterans?
Not for any veterans groups per se yet, but I have had veterans show up at shows, and of course it's really powerful when they shake my hand and tell me where they were and how much the song meant to them. It's funny. When the song came out and I was making this connection and I thought, hey, I have a song that has some relevance to the local news, then I realized I read a statistic that veterans' families make up 1% of the population. So it kind of makes sense that I play for about 100 people a night and there's usually one veteran. So it's not like I tapped into this huge zeitgeist or anything. It's a tiny portion of the country, which is really shocking to me. But making that connection is incredibly powerful.
Well, and it struck me as I listened to this whole album that a lot of the people that you are writing about and singing about are people who feel like they've kind of been passed by.
Well, I think that goes to the Woody Guthrie edict that a folk singer's job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I'm always on the lookout for underdogs who need their story told.
Well, and, you know, I've heard the same thing said about journalists, and I don't know that I ever connected what the folk singer does with what a journalist does until maybe just this very moment, but there's some overlap there.
Historically, especially, yeah. If you think about the development of journalism and the development of folk music in the earlier part of the century, yeah, they kind of did go hand in hand, exposing the evils of the world.
Speaking truth to power. And,
yeah, there you go.
So do you feel like in some small way you are working to keep some of these people from being passed by?
Oh, definitely. I do take that. I take that sort of folk music part of what I do, that tradition, very seriously, yeah.
Well, and getting back to Still Fighting the War, was it one veteran story that sparked this song in you or really reading about the issue as a whole?
I think it started reading about the issue as a whole. A particular veteran contributed to the title, actually. A buddy of mine, Ron Coy, was good friends with a Vietnam War vet who never readjusted to society completely. He passed away when I was writing this song, still battling the VA over his Agent Orange exposure. And my buddy talked about his friend Brian. My buddy Ron said, you know, it was like Brian, the whole time he was home, it was like he was still fighting the war. And so Ron provided the title of the song, talking about his friend Brian. So, yeah, there's a direct connection there. Some of the other imagery from the song came after I saw this Pulitzer Prize-winning photo essay in the Denver Post. Craig Walker is the photographer who followed a veteran around for Iraq War veteran around for, I think, 7 months in Denver and just produced this harrowing series of photographs of this guy trying so hard to readjust to life and to get back into the swing of things and failing and really struggling. It's just beautiful photographs.
Well, I was hoping, speaking of songs that you have written, you might grace us with another one from the new record.
Would love to, yes. I think let's do Rust Belt Fields. I wrote this with my old buddy Rod Picott from South Berwick, Maine as well.
This is my town, out in the Rust Belt fields. We were banging out Buicks and Oldsmobiles. There was always a job, and the money was there. Some say we got a little lazy, nobody seemed to care. But they figured it out and sent the elbow grease down to Mexico and off to the Chinese. I learned a little something about how things are. is your name just for working hard? Into the ground till your factory's cold and they tear it all down and the parts get sold. Come the bankers now picking over the bones. I got three more neighbors now about to lose their home. As they figured it out and sent the elbow grease down to Mexico and off to the Chinese. And I learned a little something about how things are. No one gets a bonus for bloody knuckles and scars. No one remembers your name just for working hard. There's a casino boat up around Boone. Think I'll buy me a bottle in a motel room. Put all I have left on a little black square. Risk it all like the big boys, like I don't even care. I'll drive you into the crowd cold, calling the auctioneer as the banks foreclose. And I learned a little something about how things are. No one gets a bonus for bloody knuckles and scars. No one remembers your name just for working hard.
Slade Cleaves with Scrappy Judd Newcomb singing Rust Belt Fields from your most recent CD, Still Fighting the War. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
That was a song that that we were listening to actually in the car the other day. I was driving, I think I was driving my daughter, she's 10, back from the ice rink. And I mentioned that I was doing this interview, and she said, well, ask him why he writes songs that make me feel so sad when he gets to the end. And I almost feel bad asking it in that way, but, you know, it's... I'll just ask that question. You know, is there something to leaving people with that feeling as the last chord is struck?
Well, there's a few answers to that. I mean, I was moved by sad songs as a young child. I mean, I remember just crying when I heard the song "Kalijah," the Hank Williams song about the wooden Indian who falls in love with the other wooden Indian across the street, and then the other wooden Indian gets taken away by somebody, and he's all alone. And so there's a ancient appeal in my bones there for the sad song. And then growing up as an adolescent, hard-hitting sad songs that sort of told my story or articulated the hard times I was going through growing up, those were very, very powerful and valuable to me.
Well, and I know your publishing company, I guess, is Magic Rat Records, and that is a character from maybe the ultimate tragic song by Bruce Springsteen.
The name of my garage band with Rod Picott in 1981 was the Magic Rats, named after the Jungle Land character.
Yeah. I'm looking at the guitar you were playing, and I can't help but ask this question. It looks like it has been part of the family for a while.
Yeah, you're right there. My dad bought it new in 1965. I was a baby. And just played it around the house. But, of course, I was enthralled every time he played it. And about 25 years ago, I borrowed it just because I had a Yamaha guitar that I played in a little band with a drummer. And I kept breaking strings because I would play so hard. So I asked my dad if I could borrow his guitar just to have something on the side of the stage as a replacement. And I soon realized it was a much better guitar than my cheap Yamaha. So I just kind of never gave it back to him. He's got a nice Martin, so he's all set.
But that has, and I don't necessarily speak guitar, but seemingly this wonderful warm sound to it.
Yeah, it's a nice guitar, and you know, it's nothing fancy, but it's just been well-worn, broken in nicely, and you know, I try to take care of it. And for a 50-year-old instrument, it's holding up pretty well. Yeah.
I would imagine that if there's any place in the world where there would be people who are good at fixing 50-year-old instruments, it would be Austin.
Yeah, there's a few down there.
Yeah, Austin kind of has everything you need in the music world, yeah.
Well, you, of course, grew up in Maine and now call Austin home. But I guess you still have strong ties to Maine. Do you see similarities between the places that you have called home, or is part of the appeal to each of them how different they are?
Well, yes and yes. Karen, my wife, and I were sure ready to get out of those Maine winters for a while. So that was part of the appeal of Texas. And yeah, Texas is a much bigger cultural change than we ever anticipated. So it's been quite an adventure learning on the ways of the Texans down there. It's like moving to another country almost. But there are some similarities. Maine being kind of off on its own, kind of isolated on the edge of the country, breeds kind of an independent spirit that is common to the Texas way of life, I think, just sort of the do-it-yourself, independent, go-your-own-way kind of spirit. And also people in Maine are super proud of their state, just like people in Texas.
You have a handful of story songs, I guess is the way to put it, in your discography, and one that I'm hoping you'll play for us in a couple minutes. But my question first is a story song a more labor-intensive enterprise than a more traditional or conventional AABA sort of song?
I actually think it's a little bit easier just because if you already have the story, then you don't have to make up very much. You already have kind of the framework to work with. You just got to figure out how to make it rhyme.
Is there – and the one we were talking about that I'm hoping you'll play is called Below, and I'll have you kind of give us a little bit of background on it. And I wonder if there's some appeal in portraying history that's often overlooked or forgotten in that same way that you're telling the story of people who have been perhaps overlooked or forgotten.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, of course, when I sing a song about a town, the time forgot sort of thing, you know, I'm singing about the people from that town, and those people show up at my shows sometimes. So, yeah, I've always maybe growing up in Maine with rooting for the Red Sox, I've always had a thing for the underdog.
Slade Cleaves and Scrappy Judd Newcomb, thank you both so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for inviting us over, man.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. And tell us just a brief snippet of what this last song is about.
Well, I don't want to give anything away. I just say that this is a song about the town of Flagstaff, Maine, which you will not see on the map unless it's a really old map.
There's an older road just off Route 9. Fades into the lake, the waterline. Sometimes I wander down that road.
Slade Cleaves, along with Scrappy Judd Newcomb, performing Cleaves' song Below in Lake Effect Studio C1. Cleaves was in Milwaukee a couple of weeks ago to perform at Shank Hall, and he stopped by the studio then. He spoke with Mitch Tyke. We'll take one last break and then return with three ideas for day trips out of town, plus the next audio postcard from the Listening to Mitchell Public Art Project. Stay tuned. Lake Effect returns on WUWM right after this.
They swore that our village should light up the land. The dusky waters move cold and slow, and the ghosts of the village.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North. With everything that Milwaukee offers during the summer, it may seem a bit silly to look farther afield for things to do. But sometimes you just want to get away for a day, but still sleep in your own bed that night. Well, we're in luck, because within an easy drive of the city are some great options for outdoor activities. Our outdoor adventure contributors, Stacey Tornio and Ken Keffer, have some suggestions.
Yeah, we have three great things. And one is for hiking, birding, and gardening. So we're going to hit three topics today. And the first is hiking in the Kettle Moraine. And that's Ken's been training for a big hike recently, and he's been doing a lot of Kettle Moraine hiking.
Yeah, I look pretty silly out there with my huge backpack on to go for a little short hike in the Kettle Moraines. But yeah, I mean, I love the Kettle Moraine State Forest out there. There's tons of great trails. There's actually a couple of different units to explore, you know. Such great geology features out there, and some pretty rugged hills to go up and down too.
So rugged hills. Talk about the scope of trails that are out there. I mean, not everybody is geared up for putting the huge pack on their back and going out for hours at a time. Are there easy trails to do as well?
Yeah, indeed. You know, I mean, there's a whole bunch of options, and it can be a short little stroll around a pretty flat area, or you can go like that Ice Age trail that's, you know, miles and miles. You explore all summer long on that thing, you know. But definitely there's some simple, easy, basic hikes. You know, there's great visitor centers out there and stuff. Stop into there. They'll set you up with some maps and let you know the best places kind of to suit your needs, whether you have an hour or you've got a whole day.
Yeah, you can kind of make it work for you and kind of, you know, test your family. If you're not used to hiking, you know, pack the snacks, pack the water, see how long you go, and always just turn back if you're ready to go back.
Don't forget the bug spray this year, though. I'm not going to lie. It's pretty intense.
Yeah.
So that's the hiking at Kettle Moraine, about an hour from here off in Waukesha County near Eagle. What about the birding activities?
One of the coolest places in all of kind of southeast Wisconsin is Horicon National Wildlife Refuge and Horicon State Park. And this is the biggest complex of kind of freshwater marshes, and it is a major bird magnet. And we're not talking some of the little brown jobs that people are like, oh, birds. You know, I mean, we're talking big, stunning, beautiful things like swans and herons and pelicans. You can see pelicans out there.
You can see pelicans out there.
Yeah, like a big – the first time I saw them, I was just – I'm like, what is that? And Ken's like, those are pelicans. It's like, what? Pelicans? Like in the middle of Wisconsin? Are you kidding? They're really great.
I had no idea that pelicans came this far north.
These are the American white pelicans. They're not the brown pelicans that you see on the coast. And so, yeah, but big, big pelicans out there doing their pelican thing.
So this is Horicon Marsh National Wildlife Refuge and State Park.
Yeah, yeah. They're side by side out there. You know, it's a long hour probably, you know, but out kind of just northwest of town, easy to get to.
And I have been there, and there are some fairly easy trails. In fact, there's essentially a boardwalk that you can take out into the marsh and see some pretty amazing birds.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little auto tour that's open. You can drive pretty deep into the marsh and then hike the dikes from there in a lot of ways. There's the boardwalk trail. Again, stop at the visitor center. You know, they'll set you up with some maps and tell you what's happening as the season progresses, you know, and it's really a great destination.
Yeah, that's a good, like, visitor centers are your friend, and like they're made for you to come and visit and ask your silly questions. Like they're there to help you. So we always stop whenever we go to a visitor center, and I'm always glad we did.
So we've covered hiking, we've covered birding. Let's talk about gardening. What's a gardening trip about?
So this one is north of Milwaukee, like around the Sheboygan area. There's this wonderful little place called Bookworm Gardens. It's kind of a younger garden, but it was started just for kids. Like it's a kid's garden, and that's really unique. Like you don't find that a lot. A lot of botanical gardens have a kid's garden element, but this one is just focusing on kids, and they have a lot of literary elements in the garden as well, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful place.
So three great places to take a trip to within about an hour's drive of Milwaukee: Kettle Moraine, Horicon Marsh, and Bookworm Gardens. Thanks to both of you.
Yeah, go check them out.
Indeed.
Stacey Tornio and Ken Keffer are the creators of the website DestinationNature.net, and they're the authors of the Kids Outdoor Adventure Book, 448 Great Things to Do in Nature Before You Grow Up. They're also our regular outdoor adventure contributors, and they spoke with Mitch Teich. Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr are Milwaukee-based artists who work together to create site-specific public art projects. Their most recent is named Listening to Mitchell, and they're sharing audio postcards from the project here on Fridays until the end of September. Here's this week's piece.
Listening to Mitchell is an installation of image and sound that transforms over 50 interviews into an experience of place and its collective memory. The installation is currently on the street, woven through historic Mitchell Street's 7 blocks from the Modjeska to St. Stan's. And throughout its duration, we're sharing the voices and sounds of Mitchell Street here on Lake Effect.
In our father's shadow.
Since he didn't say much when he said it, it was serious business.
Yeah. When father is talking, son never opened his mouth.
So in the morning, I went to get dad up. He says, Jimmy, he says, I'm so sick. He says, I don't think I can get up. And I said, Pa, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it.
All my family, my grandfather, my father, my uncles, all my family is a baker in Mexico.
That makes me a fourth generation baker, grandfather, great-grandfather, many uncles, you know. It's just, that's the family business, though.
The family owned the bank for years. My father-in-law died very suddenly, and there was no one to take his place. They asked me to do it, and I said, oh, okay, I'll do it.
My father was killed in 1994 in the jewelry store, so I took it over that very next day,
And then I came home, and I changed clothes, and I got myself a couple of blankets and a pillow. We turned all the lights down real low except for one light above the casket, and I locked the door in the church. And then I went up to the casket. I prayed for... And I went and I laid down on the pew, the front pew, with my blanket and pillow. And
it is not because of religion, but social tradition to carry on and on and on from father to grandfather to great-grandfather.
Listening to Mitchell is a public art project by Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr. The project's 18-channel immersive audio installation at 723 West Historic Mitchell Street is open Thursdays and Fridays from 3 to 6:30, as well as on Sunday from 2 to 5. To learn more about Listening to Mitchell events and happenings, you'll find a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And don't forget, you can hear the next radio installment in the series next Friday on Lake Effect. And that's all the time we have today. We're produced by Mitch Tyke and Dan Harmon, with web assistance from Michelle Maternowski, studio engineering from John Strelecki, and production assistance from Brooke Dowden, Eleanor Peterson, and Audrey Nowakowski. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow and Sunday for Lake Effect Weekend starting at 3 o'clock, and be back here again on Monday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.